Today is Sunday, August 15, 2021. This is part 20 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, last name spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing fine today, Tom. How are you?
Great. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, of course.
Sweet. Thank you. Last time we left off, you had spent some time in Clear Creek in the spring of 2005. And then in the fall of, in October of 2005, you headed out once again to the north side of Grand Canyon. Can you pick that up?
You bet. For sure. So it's kind of interesting, and this point here touches on what we've talked in the past about flexibility of trip planning and being able to adjust on the fly. Because this trip in October, we had originally envisioned it as a three-person trip, Bruce, Grubbs, and Art, and myself, and we wanted to go down Crystal and then go along the Tonto over to Shinimo and come up the Flint Tuna Saddle there, and maybe Art and I would climb Fan Island. That was kind of the framework for this trip. But a week or so before we were ready to put it into action, Bruce decided, or he realized he would not be able to go with us. I guess he had a flying commitment. And on top of that, Art had been watching the weather, and he said, you know, there's been some good monsoon rains in the canyon area, and this would be a good time to go out on the Esplanade.
Huh.
And we had, you know, by this time we had more or less covered the Esplanade around Great Thumb, and we had been looking to the north across the Colorado at the vast expanses up there,
mm-hmm.
and we thought, well, this would be a good opportunity to, you know, with this recent weather, and the fact that Bruce couldn't make it on the trip, and he really wanted to do that Crystal to Shinimo loop, we decided to postpone that and go for the Esplanade instead, just Art and I, the two of us, right?
Okay.
So that was the plan that came down finally a week before we left, I guess. And so I flew down on the 23rd of October and met Art. He met me at the airport there. And we went up to Flagstaff and did some last-minute shopping there and spent the night, actually, in Flagstaff with Bruce and Duart. Bruce Grubbs and Duart Martin,
uh-huh.
whom we've met before. And then in the morning, Art and I got a really early start and headed north. And I remember I was refreshing my notes on this and looking at photos. And, you know, we stopped, as was tradition, whenever we crossed into the Marble Platform area, we would always stop at Marble Canyon Lodge, you know. And so we left Flagstaff early enough to have a reasonable breakfast at the Marble Canyon Lodge there. And I remember our weight person, who we met many times over the years, a Navajo named Vera, you know, was our waitress that morning. And it's just a really fine experience. And it's just more poignant now, of course, because the lodge is gone, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And that really fine, beautiful cafe and restaurant and gift shop has been, unfortunately, totally transformed. So, anyways, I have a very fond memory of that experience and having breakfast with Vera, who was always just the nicest of people, right? And
hey, Jim.
Yeah.
What do you remember of the old lodge?
The old lodge, well,
before the fire.
Yeah. It's hard to summarize it, but it's just the character and the atmosphere of it was so distinctive. I mean, the closest thing I could say would be to compare it with the lodge at Jacobs Lake, right?
Okay.
up on the plateau.
Uh-huh.
But the primary thing I think that really sticks in my mind was the wood of the paneling, not paneling, but wood planks that they used throughout the lodge, and probably contributed to its burning, I suspect. But this, I don't know what kind of wood was, maybe a maple or something, but planks about 8 to 10 inches wide,
mm-hmm.
and they had the original knots, in them, you know, so you could see this characteristic pattern and contrast between the knotty. Maybe it was just pine. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But it was nicely finished, and it had a kind of a yellowish orangish coloration to it. You know, mm-hmm. It was just a very, very comforting experience. It kind of felt like, you know, you were in a lodge from the 1920s in the middle of the forest where hunters would come and go. And I mean, it's not really the middle of the forest on marble platform, but that's the kind of experience I had in that place. And it just was very historical because they had all these photos of early river runners.
Can you describe the layout of the building? How did it lay out for you? Where were the doors? How'd you come in? What was it like?
Okay,
the reason I'm asking is I realize I have never, in these recorded interviews, talked to anybody about the lodge and about what it was like before the fire. So let's do that now, if you will.
Sure, yeah, I'll give you my recollection as best I can.
Great.
And of course the front, the outside, was just a beautiful kind of, you know, western high desert facade of sandstone blocks, right, with mesquite pile timbers for, I'm assuming, some sort of timbers for supporting the entrance veranda.
Weren't they kind of big, sort of almost like trunks of pines?
Yeah, they probably were ponderosa from up on the plateau, now that I think about it. Yeah, I'm getting
kind of holding the porch up.
Yeah, that's right. And they were very smoothened from many years of sitting there,
right,
and people rubbing their hands on them and whatnot. So, but that was very distinctive. And of course, you had these screen doors that opened up side by side. I believe it was two next to each other. And you'd open those screen doors and step inside, and it was like entering a new, you know, a wonderland almost, because you are outside and you've been driving across the plateau, and it's, you know, it's bright, it's hard on your eyes. There, you look for long distances, and all you see are the rocks of the Vermilion Cliffs or the Echo Cliffs and the plateau, you know, shooting out in its vastness ahead of you. And with really nothing on it, you know, and then when you step inside this, and it's hot. Usually, it's hot at some level when I was there, and we'd open the doors and step in, and it was just like a transformation, you know. You just felt instantly at home there, even though I'd only visited once or twice a year. I always felt like this was a real grounding point, you know, that that you really could. I could really relate to and feel comfortable in. And the staff were always so accommodating and friendly too. So anyways, you first walk in and there was a gift shop, mm-hmm, that had many different things in it, but it had a really well-stocked library, a bookstore of recent Grand Canyon titles. So there was always something there to pick up, you know. One of your books, Tom, Hikes from the River, or, you know, the latest river running book, you know, they were always there in good stock. And so you could pick up some reading to take back with you. And then, of course, there was lots of other tourist type stuff that we didn't really spend too much time in because it was not any of our interest. That kind of stuff that we had or that we wanted, we already had. And then there would be also, there was some goods for the river runners, right? People who needed last-minute suntan lotion or hats or sandals or things like that, right? And it was a pretty nicely little stocked store, right? And then as you're entering the lodge, you would turn to the – you'd walk in through the doors into the gift shop area, and then to the left there would be an open open part in the wall, big arch, and that opened up into the cafe.
Wasn't there a kind of a rug room in the back, back by the books, a little further past the books? Is there sort of a
no,
I'm missing that up. All right.
Well, it could be, Tom. It could be. You know, I'm also thinking here of the much larger trading post at Cameron, right, which has a huge rug room.
Yeah, yeah,
but,
yeah. No, I'm probably
but
I
can't remember a distinct rug room there, but yeah, I'd have to look at my photos and perhaps yeah. that would twig me. But no, I can't recall, and it could very well be. It would make sense that they would have that there, but I don't remember it. It's not. Not
yeah.
present in my memory. So,
so you go
but
through
then,
this kind of rectangular opening past the in the from the sales area and go into the dining area. What was that like?
Yeah, and so there was. So when you're entering the dining area, you're facing to the west, and in the building, and to your left. So on the south side of the building, there were windows there, of course, and booths. That would hold like six people each, or four, or
mm-hmm.
you know, two, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a row of tables that were for larger parties, where they could, if they had a busload come in, I guess they could put 25 people. They could put the tables together and put a lot of people in there. And then there was a diner bar where you had stools, right, and people
right.
could sit there and then behind that area. So this was from south to north, these three areas I just defined, and then the cooking actually took place on the north end there, or at least the preparation of the dishes to come to the table. I think there was a wall between there and the actual kitchen,
mm-hmm.
With a window that you could see into. So and again, all this area was decorated with artwork and crafts and photographs of river runners. And you would go in there and you'd essentially put in your order with Vera. You know, she'd come to your table and you'd take your order and have a nice chat. And then while you're waiting, you kind of walk around and look at all the stuff on the walls, you know, because it was just so informative. And it's basically, you know, a part of the historical record of the early river running, and it was very, very educational to see these photos, and you know, you could see the change in the technology, right, with the huge in the photographs that were on the wall there, with the huge baloney boats,
mm-hmm.
which came into vogue, I guess, in the 40s and 50s, and then the transition to more, you know, to smaller dory type boats and whatnot. That was all kind of recorded in the photographs that were on the wall. And I guess all those were lost, so hopefully there were backup copies somewhere. I don't know, but and then beyond that, I think there was a further area where they could open up in the cafe. They farther to the west, there was another area which they could open up for very large groups when
mm-hmm.
they had a big
That's right.
big group coming. And I don't remember ever seeing that open. So. It could be that it wasn't used very much. It could be that I'm exaggerating in my memory how big it actually was. But that's my kind of impression of it. And again,
mm-hmm.
you know, throughout you had this beautiful pine, presumably this kind of yellow orange finished pine with the knots in it, and you had, I believe, they had green linen drapes or what do you call the pull. You pull across the window to shut it. Anyways,
yeah.
curtains on the sides of the curtains, right? On the sides of the windows, you'd have these curtains that were pulled back. Of course, the view was always unobstructed, and just a very friendly place with nice formica tops, you know, on the tables, and so it's just a very nice place to call home whenever I, you know, came into Marble Canyon and was passing through. We always would stop there, and you know, there were the other two places too in the vicinity, but you know, because of the historical aspect, and some of those both also were pretty old too, and but for some reason Marble Canyon just always affected me the most, right?
Uh-huh.
But now of course we'll go to the other two facilities. I'm kind of having a senior moment here, and I'm forgetting the names of the two.
So Cliff Dwellers and
Cliff Dwellers
Cliffs.
And And what was the second
one? Vermilion Cliffs.
Vermilion Cliffs, yeah. And those are, you know, similar genre, smaller, I guess, and definitely smaller. And they definitely fill the niche now, I think, because unfortunately they haven't been able to recreate the style, the old style of Marble Canyon Lodge in the renovation. I mean, it's a nice facility, and the food's still good, but but as far as the character goes, it's lacking, you know.
Right.
And whereas Cliff Dwellers and Vermilion Cliffs still retain that character. So
it's funny. I wonder the generation that missed the old lodge, when they come into the new lodge and go get something to eat and then head on their way, do they anchor into that place too? And you'd assume that they do. They don't know what the old place was like, but it's kind of an interesting question.
Yeah, I think it would be an interesting question, and I would suggest that it would, you know, happen differently to different people. But I can think, I mean, if it, in my experience, you know, let's say I was a 16-year-old going on my first river running trip, maybe with my family, probably with my parents, you know, or uncle or somebody, and we're going down. And we're starting in, close to Cliff Dweller, close to Marble Canyon, you know.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we'd stay there for the night before we went over to Lee's Ferry and put out. But I could see that this adventure of a lifetime, you know, would be, this would be your starting point.
Right.
And it would have a big impact on how you related to the trip overall, potentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in that case, it could potentially have as significant an impact on a person as the old one did on me, right?
Yeah.
The new one could.
Yeah.
So, I mean, other people probably didn't feel either anything about the old format of the cafe and lodge, right? That they just weren't interested in that, so it doesn't really have any impact on them. But yeah, I could see that. It just kind of depends on the emotional impact these places have on your, well, you know, your personal being and the value you put on these characteristics, right? These places,
right?
And as a grounding experience, you know, and so yeah, it's an interesting topic for discussion,
yeah.
That's for sure. But
okay,
but
so
I really miss that old lodge, you know.
Yeah. Breakfast with Vera and Art at Marble Canyon Lodge, and then what did you do?
Yeah, and so from there we, you know, this is kind of like the traditional start of the trip, right? You have breakfast at the lodge, and then we headed up to the Jacob Lake and filled up Art's Subaru for the trip to head out to. So the new plan then was, instead of doing Crystal to Shinumo loop, then Art and I were going to go out to Indian Hollow and drop down onto the Esplanade there and then walk around Fishtail Mesa. And we thought we could get Fishtail, as far as summits go, we figured we could get Fishtail, and Cogswell Butte was on our list, and Racetrack Knoll, those three, right?
Okay.
That seemed like within the week we had, we could probably pull in all three of those. So that was the plan, and we drove out to Indian Hollow, and then parked the car there at close to the campground at the trailhead for Thunder River Trail, and then started down the trail. And of course, that trail receives a lot of use, right? There's a lot of activity on it, probably not as much as it used to get, because a lot of the people who go down the Thunder River now just take the Bill Hall Trail down at Monument Point, so it's a much shorter route. But this is a pretty nice route, you know, to get into Thunder River. And I remember when I was young, I went through all the Arizona highways issues, right, to try and find any articles about the Grand Canyon. And you know, back then it wasn't – these things weren't digitized, so you had to actually go through the, you know, pull the bound volumes off the library shelf and go through the whole, you know, a whole volume looking for an article about Grand Canyon. But there was a nice article in Arizona Highways about, you know, going down this trail and the Thunder River Trail and using that to access the Thunder River area, right? That was the traditional access point. And so it was kind of it was fun to go and hike down this trail, because quite honestly, this is the first time I'd actually ever accessed the uppermost parts of that trail. I'd been along the lower parts, but not on the high parts. So, so we headed down there, and then where it the trail then goes to the east and follows, you know, pretty much at constant elevation in the Esplanade for a few miles to the east before it heads south and then goes down to Thunder River. But at that point where it heads east, we dropped off the trail there and started walking down towards what's called Cranberry Canyon. And so Cranberry is between Deer Creek and Fishtail Canyon. It's an informally named canyon. And there's a redwall route through it. And so what we had planned to do here was to hike down into Cranberry Canyon and camp there. And then we would take a bunch of water and descend the redwall in the break, which is actually just east of Cranberry Canyon itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's about half a kilometer to the east. And then we were going to go and hike over to Deer Creek, and then climb Cogswell Butte. This is a day hike, right? Cogswell Butte, and then come back up to the Esplanade and follow it around. Potentially, we were going to go up Deer Creek. That's right. We were going to go up the east arm of Deer Creek and then climb Cogswell Butte and then follow the trail back around into Cranberry Canyon where we'd meet our packs.
That
and,
just sounds unrealistically...
Unrealistic. Optimistic.
Yeah, optimistic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes I think, how come I can't, after all these years, how come I can't accurately predict these things, you know? Mm. I think...
But it's
I'll tell you,
we ought to be able to get over there and back in a day.
For sure. For sure. I mean, we'll talk eventually about when I went down to climb Charybdis Butte with my friend Mark Coleman, and boy, we really underestimated that one, but anyway, I did. He had never been in a canyon. So anyways, this was the plan that Art and I had, and we went down We went down Cranberry Canyon, and there's a nice spring in there, and you can access it pretty easily by just from the bed, right? And we dropped our packs at the rim of the red wall on the east side of Cranberry Canyon, just above the junction with the Colorado River. So we had a spectacular view there. And that was our campsite for the night.
Okay.
So the idea was, okay, we were able to fill up quite a bit of water at the spring in Cranberry Canyon. And then we would have plenty of water to do this
at Deer
Creek. Day hike.
Yeah, and you have water at Deer Creek. So I see, if you're at the top of the Cranberry Canyon Redwall route, then that to Cogswell Butte and back in a day is not impossible.
No, it's not. I don't think it was that out of the question. But anyways, it's funny how these things go. In the morning we got up and we just put on our day packs with our water and then we started down the descent, right? And it's a little ways to the east. The actual descent is a little ways to the east of where we camped, a half a K, as I mentioned. But we poked around. I remember there was a cairn in the first gully. So there's like two parallel gullies that are kind of east facing.
Right.
And there was a cairn in the first one, but we didn't see anything obvious there. So as far as descent goes, and so we poked around and we went over to the second one to the north.
Right.
Second gully, and that was even worse looking. So we figured, okay, we got to go back to the first gully. That must be the route. And we went down, and we worked our way down a ways, and then we get to obviously the crux, the steepest part. And I tell you, Art just went right down this thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said it's kind of tricky. He said, I think it looks better if you go around the rib, because I'm above him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking up, and he says, I think if you go around the rib between where you are now and the little tiny gully to the north, you might be able to get down that easier. So
So
I tried it. I went and, poked around there, and I said, no, I don't think so. I'll come back and do what you did. So I came back, and I start backing down, you know, and it's like I just could not put the footsteps together,
It's a very visually challenging kind of downcline there.
Yeah, for sure. And again, as I mentioned, Art just went right down it. You know, he just scampered down like it was nothing, and it made me feel like, yeah, this is, you know, he's 4 years older than me, and I can't keep up with him, right? Mm-hmm. So, but anyways, I backed off it, quite honestly, and I just said, it's not going to happen today, you know, and so at that point, you know, he comes back up, and we have to recalculate the day, right? Which is, like, we do this all the time, so it's not a problem, and certainly nobody, none of the people I've ever hiked with ever gets upset if an objective is not met, you know, because one individual has a challenge with
exactly.
it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, if you have that kind of a hiking relationship, I don't know, I figure it's time to move on to somebody else, right, to hike with. But and I don't want to get in trouble, right? So the easiest way to get in trouble is to push your partner to do something that they don't want to do.
That's right.
Or, you know, not stand up to your partner when you don't feel comfortable, right?
Right.
So anyways, it was fine. We knew there was always going to be another opportunity to come up Cranberry Canyon. You know, we can go back there and try it again. And so we reversed our route, right? So we hiked then back up the bed of Cranberry, the Redwall Rim first, into the bed, and then followed it up to the Esplanade. And from there, then we headed to the west. And there's a number of cowboy camps out there.
Right.
One of them is, which is above Cranberry Canyon. I think it's called Ghost Camp. And it's got these interesting rock art.
Ghost rock. Yeah.
Ghost rock. Yes, that's right. And cowboy detritus around it, and then there was also another one which was called what was that called? Bean Camp, I think, which was farther to the west,
right?
Just down below Fishtail, below the saddle, east of Fishtail. So we essentially followed the Esplanade around that way, and when we got into on the east side of Fishtail, that's where we camped that day.
Okay.
So we, you know, coming back, our false start on going down Cranberry and then coming back, working our way up to the Esplanade and then going west got us around to Fishtail. And partly we wanted to explore a little bit of Fishtail because we could see that there was a nice spring down in the Supai from the Esplanade. We could look down and see this. And so the question is, can we get down there and what's it look like? And we thought maybe we could work our way down into the Redwall and Fishtail and just take a general look at it. So so we dropped our packs where we were going to camp there or close to where we were going to camp. That's right. And we started down and then, ironically, we ran into this well-constructed trail.
Yes.
And sounds like you're familiar with it, but we didn't know it was there. And I guess... You know, in retrospect, with that beautiful spring there, which we were able to get to by going down this trail, you know, this was accessing the water source for the cowboys and stockmen who were running cattle up there. So, but you know, it was kind of interesting to run across that, and when you're not expecting it, and to be able to use it because it makes your traveling quite a bit easier, right? So. And when we got down to the creek then, we worked our way down to the upper part of the Redwall.
Mm-hmm.
Because neither of us knew for sure that you could not get out Fishtail, right? I still don't know for sure if it's feasible or not. I know Deer Creek.
There is a route through the Redwall on the west side of Fishtail, on the south, just into the drainage, and you can see it from the river pretty clearly. It's a nose, Redwall nose that comes down there. But I don't know of anybody who's made it without rope work.
Farther up
in the drainage. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. We were poking around and we were looking down in there. We could see that you could bypass a couple of falls in the upper part of the Redwall.
Yeah.
but we could not see all the way through, so we weren't going to push it, right?
Yeah.
And so we figured it's another day, but it's good to know that you've been up there just by the close to the mouth.
Yeah.
All right.
That,
so
that, and that gets you up to the Esplanade.
Uh-huh.
It's a wonderful, wonderful route.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, I'll keep that in mind for future work, future hiking. So, anyways, we actually moved our packs a little bit farther along to the north because we were closer to this bean camp. Probably the Esplanade Terrace bench between the two arms of Fishdale. So just south, a little bit south and east of the saddle between Fishtail Mesa and the rim.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had the Esplanade out there is just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Just gorgeous sidewalks and park. I mean, it's like you can't describe how expansive these slabs are and how they just continue mile after mile. It's like walking on sidewalks for miles, and it's like some of the easiest hiking I've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while you get stuck, right? Your ledge will pinch out.
Right.
And so you just backtrack 100 feet or a couple hundred feet, and you'll find a way up, and you go up, you know, to the next level.
That's
and then
right.
take off,
yeah.
right? And this time, this year at this time, we were finding water everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, like, really, really wonderful because
nice.
I've got it written in my notes that we were passing, like, hidden gardens in these slot canyons and
oh, wow.
hoodoos and mushrooms of sandstone.
Yep, yep.
And it's
yep.
just really a unique, unique, wonderful landscape.
It is.
And so we had a lot of fun out there. And when we actually just in the morning, so we camped there just south of the saddle. And in the morning, we quickly, there's a Coconino talus cone that goes up, and it actually had a pretty good deer trail on it
mm-hmm.
that we took. We just went up to the saddle just to look over and into the Indian Hollow drainage.
Yeah.
And so that was just a little day jaunt. And then we came back down. This was early in the morning. And then we followed the Esplanade to the south and west, and again, past all these beautiful, beautiful Esplanade sandstone displays.
Yeah.
And eventually, then we put our camp, our next camp, down at the south end of Fishtail Mesa.
Okay.
On the east side of the point. So we here now we would have been overlooking the juncture of Fishtail Canyon and the Colorado River.
Right.
So above that red wall fin you were talking about.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And just spectacular views, you know, and
yeah.
you can just imagine you really, really got a tremendous view of everything. And I remember talking with Art, and we're looking to the south, and, you know, you can look across the Colorado River, and you can see all these terraces. And we had been all these places, you know, all
yeah.
these terraces we had hiked out on. And, you know, you could pick out places that you distinctly remember, you know, like laying under that particular rock over there, you know,
cool.
it's like 4 or 5 kilometers away, but you know, you could see it. And it was really, really kind of exhilarating, you know,
so this,
to be in this.
You
yeah.
guys are in that formation on the Esplanade. I think it's called Duck Leading the Wagon Train as the unofficial name of what it looks like from the river looking up to the skyline there.
Oh, really?
There's it looks like a duck leading a wagon train. So you guys were at the Duck and Wagon Train camping there looking down to the river.
Yeah.
In that whole Deer Creek to Pete's Creek run. It's just a gorgeous section of canyon to look down into.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You got just tremendous views. You know, and the neat thing is we're hikers, right? We don't, I mean, each of us, Art and I have both done river trips in our careers, but we're not river runners, you know.
Right.
And, I mean, I'd love to be able to do it more, but, you know, I only got so much time, right? And I don't have the gear for it, right?
Yeah.
That's another thing,
yeah.
too. So, but you can always, when you're out here, you always see river runners, right? They're
yeah.
always down there below you. And it's kind of neat that, you know, there's this connection. Obviously, it's a one-way connection because they rarely see us.
Correct.
But it is kind of neat to look down, you know, 2,500 feet, and, you know, right down below you, you see these little specks of
yeah.
of kayaks and dories and you know, baloney boats running mm-hmm. the river, right, mm-hmm. and doing their thing. So, yeah, it's pretty neat, a wonderful area to go hiking in. So,
yeah.
So we started out then. The next morning we hiked along the Esplanade south of Fishtail there to the west, and we went a little bit north along the Esplanade along the west side, and we dropped our packs there because the objective was we wanted to do another day hike, Esplanade day hike, down and out to the overlook of the junction with Kanab and the
Ooh.
River.
Uh-huh.
And you know, one thing that was interesting, Tom, that I wanted to bring to your attention was we did see, you know, from the area of, like, Bean Camp to the west, we did not see any mescal pits
right.
anywhere out there, anywhere to the west of Fishtail Mesa. It was very interesting because they're very abundant to the east, but it just seemed like the Aboriginal youth dropped off out there for some reason. Just pointing that out. I mean,
yeah.
you know, there's probably somebody's done a survey and they've identified 50 or 100 of them out there, but we didn't see any. You know, and,
well,
and
was it the lack of agave?
Well, that could very well be. You know, I mean,
yeah,
I hate to say. You know, that there wasn't any agave there 700, 800 years ago, right?
Right.
But anyways, I you know, it could very well have been that. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was just a little bit drier, right? Because...
And it is a, you know, when you think about it, going from Bean Camp, as you say, west to Kanab Canyon, and then north, and then back to the east to Racetrack Knoll, then you have to go back south again to kind of exit off that bench of Esplanade. It's kind of a perched area there.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a funny sort of loop, if you will. And so maybe it wasn't as attractive as a place to live.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's something to ponder, though, and it'd be interesting to see if the archaeologists have any information or thinking about that, you know. So.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, so to get back to our hiking here, yeah, we dropped our packs then, you know, mid-morning, and then headed south west out there, gradually descending out to the point that is on the east side of Kanab Creek.
Right.
So the top of the Esplanade there. Well, it's just the top of the Supai. I mean, you've come down through a fair amount of the Esplanade, through a fair amount of the Supai sandstone. And the Esplanade sandstone being the top unit of the Supai group, we would have left that way behind. So we walked down as far as we could there to the final cliffs of the Supai,
mm-hmm.
And then just had the view, right? And I remember there was no cairn there, which was kind of interesting,
uh-huh.
because usually in these kind of, you know, really highlighted spots, like the junction of Kanab Creek and the river, you know, you would find... a cairn out there, but we didn't see any, which was kind of puzzling. I'm not saying that nobody ever went out there. I'm sure people go out there all the time, but it was just kind of puzzling, you know.
I don't think a lot of people go out there, Jim.
Uh-huh.
It just, well, not maybe more so now, but...
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, maybe they'll go out there now
after they
hear this trip, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but anyways, we, you know, it was just, again, just fabulous Esplanade wilderness, you know, just... really exciting place to be and very satisfying to hike around out there. So we, you know, we had just a moseying day. We hiked north from that point then, and we wanted to get down to the Redwall Rim if we could, right, to hike along a little bit of Kanab Creek below the Redwall and above the Redwall, I'm sorry.
Right.
And so we actually were able to find a route down about a mile to the northeast of the point.
Huh.
And you know, we had to work our way down through various cliffs, through various ledges and whatnot, but we could get down to the Redwall Rim, and of course then you got a much neater view right down
yeah.
into Kanab Creek. You know, you're looking down 2,500 feet, right? And and then we follow the Redwall Rim around up to the drainage with Whispering Falls in it.
Yes.
And I don't know if that drainage has a name, an informal name, but we could, you know, we had a spectacular view looking right down on the falls. And we didn't really expect to see this, the falls, so fantastically displayed. We kind of figured it would be hidden to us, you know, from view. But we, since we were on the red wall looking right down at it, and it kind of it's south-facing, you know, we had a tremendous view of it. And I remember thinking at the time that, you know, I could look down in Kanab, and I could look down in Whispering Falls Drainage there, and Kanab Creek in particular, and I was thinking to myself, wow, this is where you went, you know, on that big hike you did right out of high school, you know, and that was 32 years before Art and I were looking down on it, right?
Yeah.
And so, and this trip with Art was 16 years ago this fall. So, you know, putting the two figures together, it means I'd hiked down there 48 years ago from now, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to believe that I'm that old.
Well, it's a lifetime of Grand Canyon hiking.
Yeah, I guess that's right, right. So anyway, we had this great view, and one of the things that is really neat for me is to look down on places like Whispering Falls or what's the other one, Elk Chasm, you know, and you can see the trails, right,
yeah,
that the river runners have made and the hikers. Right. And so there's a lot of people come up to Whispering Falls from below, and we could see the, you know, trails that hikers and or sheep, perhaps, had made, and you could actually, you know, you could see trails that came in above the falls that worked their way in.
Interesting.
And from what I understand is you can access those trails from Kanab Creek itself, so north of the junction with the drainage of Whispering Falls Creek on the east side of Kanab. You work your way up there, and then you come around the corner,
come back,
and you can work your way in on these trails to get above Whispering Falls.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
I don't know if, you know, the if one can then go from there up through the red wall all the way, but I suspect not. But people obviously are, you know, kind of getting into this area and hiking around the falls. And
yeah,
and it's neat to see these trails because, of course, you want to come back and you want to hike those trails too, right?
Right.
So
right.
It's an objective for a future trip. So, but so anyways, We followed the red wall a little bit to the east, and this, you know, when we had gotten down through the Supai farther south to get down to the red wall rim in Kanab, we found a route down, but then the cliff was pretty continuous that we, you know, had come down.
The Esplanade
cliff. As we moved north, it was just a continuous cliff, and we're wondering if we're going to have to, you know, backtrack.
Right.
All the way to where we had come down through the Supai cliffs. But fortunately, as we went around the corner there and headed up Whispering Falls Drainage, there was a fairly straightforward game trail that worked its way up the drainage there that heads up towards Fishtail Point.
Right.
But, you know, so it was it all worked out perfect.
Nice.
Yeah. And so then we just walked our way back up to the top of the Esplanade, where we stashed our pack in the early part of the day, and then we hiked a little bit to the north into pretty much the first drainage that we came across with water, a little bit of a flow or pockets, and decided to camp there for the night. And it was looking threatening at this point. The weather was looking kind of threatening, with lots of you know, cumulus and high clouds and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we put up the tent. So when I say a tent, it's basically a fly that Art has constructed. And you know, I actually elected to sleep in the tent, and he said he would stay out. But in the middle of the night, it started up, and he scampered in and joined me there. And that was the beginning of a couple of days of rain. Right, it was kind of unusual, but it was. So our plan for the next couple of days was to kind of walk our way north on this esplanade, and there's two more large terraces, right, that one can explore that are west of Fishtail.
Right.
Don't have names, but these are between Racetrack Knoll on the north and then the Colorado River on the south, right? There's basically three main terraces, and the first day we were out there, we did the first of these three terraces. But with the rain and that morning, we just kind of decided to take it easy and poke along. And I have this photograph that I took. You see, we broke our camp and then just decided, because we wanted to get out of the rain, right? We broke our camp and walked a little bit north and found this fantastic overhang that was very open, right? Fortunately, this rain was not accompanied by wind. It was just a constant rain that was coming down vertically.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this overhang was spacious enough that you could get out, you know, well back from the drip line and just sit there. And I had this beautiful picture of Art just sitting there laying on his back, you know, with his back against his pack, got his toque on, he's writing notes, you know, and then behind him is the Esplanade just stretching out into the misty distance, you know. And it really, just a very evocative photo, particularly, you know, for me, because I was there, and it brings back all these, you know, feelings of what it was like to experience that. And I mean, you get an opportunity like that to just sit back and relax and let the rain kind of just come down, you know, and take it easy, right? You know,
take
advantage of it.
Yeah.
So we just said, let's kind of just sit here and relax, and we'll walk slowly between rainstorms, work our way north, and we'll just pass on the day hikes out on these terraces, right? So that's what we did that day, and we basically worked our way up to the neck of land that goes between Fishtail and out to Racetrack Knoll. And so we figured we were going to camp there, and then the next day we would do a day hike out to Racetrack Knoll and out towards the Jump Up Canyon area.
Uh-huh.
So again, that night, it started raining just before we went to bed, and we actually were able to find a really nice, well, I shouldn't say that, but a good overhang just a little bit to the east and below the Esplanade, you know, top of the Esplanade. And get out of the rain enough there, so that was that gave us enough shelter. We didn't have to put up the tent.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the morning, then it started to break up, right? The weather, and so we had this walk out to Racetrack Knoll, and it's a very simple walk, right? It's just you just walk up a shale slope to the summit. But I have a picture of me taken from the top looking down the East Ridge, and Art is coming up, you know, with his day pack on and his hiking stick, and it's just got the whole Esplanade laid out behind him, you know, with these tendrils of cloud, you know, going in and out of some of the side canyons, and because it had stopped raining, but it hadn't completely broken up all the clouds, and so it was just a very neat photograph of him coming up the knoll. And so I remember that there had been a couple people up there like 10 or 12 days before us, according to the register. So we were kind of surprised from that because we hadn't seen too many tracks on this whole hike. But you know, a useful reminder that people do get out there. So it was kind of fun to come across that. And so we had the whole day ahead of us, and we decided to walk then from the top of Racetrack Knoll. We walked west, heading for Jump Up.
Okay.
And if you go pretty much due west from Racetrack Knoll, you can follow the ridges down, and there's a point there that just basically looks right down. This is a point in the Supai Group. It looks right down on the junction of Jump Up with Knab Creek.
Okay.
And so what we wanted to do was try and get down to the red wall rim there, if we could, and check it out. But turns out there was a kind of a persistent cliff, the same one we'd been dealing with a couple days prior, you know. And so we had to poke around before we finally found a series of chimneys that we could down climb that would get us through that particular cliff. And from there, it was just a straight shot down to the red wall rim and an easy walk to go down and look right down into Knab Creek. And, you know, again, it's just this spectacular cut. And it's kind of amazing that Knab Creek goes so far for such a long distance through the red wall with no major, you know, dry falls or major falls, right, that you can't get around.
Right.
It's just, and so, these other drainages, too, are similar, right, that they get so narrow, but they're a persistent walkway. You can hike through them without any real difficulties. So just really spectacular views. And from there, we just hiked up, followed the rim of Jump Up, and back. Well, heading for the heading up for Indian Hollow, and basically back to the Esplanade. It was quite a long day, and I remember thinking that that Jump Up, once you get above the red wall there, I remember thinking, well, this is a nice Supai side canyon, but it's not the nicest. Mm. It's not in the nicest, you know. And this would be in the Indian Hollow drainage.
Right.
So Indian Hollow comes down and joins Jump Up, and so we hiked up Jump Up along the red wall rim, and then turned into Indian Hollow, following the red wall there.
Okay.
And it's just, it's a nice canyon, but it's not nearly as pretty as some of the others that we've encountered. I remember being very wide. That may be one thing. It was very wide and open, and it didn't have the same feel. But nonetheless, it was fairly easy walking. So we made quick time back up through the canyon there, and we came back up then to the Esplanade and found our pack where we'd left it at the campsite the night before. And then we decided to move farther, rather than camping there that night again, we decided to move farther to the east, because the next day, our penultimate day, we wanted to hike up on Fishtail Mesa.
Okay, right.
So we did move our camp, I don't know, a couple miles to the east, and to be in a better position for Fishtail Mesa.
Yeah.
So by now the weather was great. We were having spectacular weather. So that storm was a couple day storm that passed through and refreshed the pocket holes and all the creeks and whatnot. So we certainly weren't worrying about water at that point. But the next morning, then we got up and we moved our packs then even farther east to just below the ascent of where you go up for Fishtail.
Okay.
And there's a nice trail, game trail, that goes up through there. And I guess a lot of people have been up there. I've been actually doing some research. I'm trying to find out, you know, the earliest recorded ascent of it. And I've got, I'm sure it was much earlier than this, but I've got researchers who were up there in the 20s, you know.
That's right.
Yeah, they were following the lure of the isolated mesas that might have had like Cape, you know, Cape Wotan's Throne, for instance, or a Shiva Temple, which were isolated from the main rim and consequently might have experienced independent evolution of
dinosaurs.
Of
still had
dinosaurs. Yeah, exactly. And so there were some surveys done up there in the 20s that I've found written up, but nothing earlier. And I you know, I'm curious to know, like, who might have been up there,
first, and made
a record.
What is interesting about that area is it hasn't been grazed by cattle. Of course, it is grazed by deer and sheep, mountain sheep. So the bighorns. It is a sky island that is, in a way, unique. But like you say, there's a walking trail that kind of goes right up the thing. So
yeah, well, I do remember that there was like a 6 or 8 foot cliff in it, you know, and it was very easy to scramble up, and it was obvious that deer and sheep would go up this, but you know, it might have been too much for cows. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, I definitely think it'd be too much for cattle.
Yeah. So I can that makes sense. I didn't realize that had been ungrazed. So that's pretty interesting. I wish I'd known that before we went there. It would have been interesting to think about that when we were walking out Fishtail. But anyway, I do remember that there was lots of really high grass, you know.
Uh-huh.
And we had seen this before on the Esplanade, on some of the terraces around Powell Plateau. You know, you'd be going through grass up to your mid-thigh, right? And so some of that was present along the walkout out Fishtail.
Right.
So our objective for this day was to actually go out to the south end of Fishtail and then walk the west rim out to the northwest point.
Okay.
And then come back along the north side, kind of do a loop, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but don't know what it was, but it took us a while to get to the south end. And I remember copper mineralization out there, too. There's a big east-west trending fault that drops down, I guess, the actual point from the main block of the mesa. And there was a lot of copper coloring in there. That's not why we were slow, but we did decide at that point that rather than do the loop around the rim of Fishtail that we had anticipated, that we would just go back along the east rim as we had come down, and then when we got to the appropriate place, we'd make a beeline for the northwest point, which would give us a great view down into Indian Hollow, right? But even when we got to that point and had to make the decision, we felt like it was kind of late in the day to do this, and we were kind of tired. It took us longer to do this hike out Fishtail than we expected. And I'm not quite sure why, because I don't recall it being at all, you know, challenging or difficult. But sometimes these things happen, you know, so it's not that big a deal. But, you know, the important thing is you want to get we always want to get back to camp before it gets dark, you know, if we can avoid it. So that we like to relax in the camp, and of course, then you get a good night's sleep, too, for the next day, so... So we got back to camp and you know, had an enjoyable evening there, just in Basin Hollow. I'm sorry, Indian Hollow.
Right.
Down in the bed there.
Did you notice any of the sinkholes up on top of Fishtail Mesa?
I don't recall it. I mean, I didn't make a mental note of that for sure. No. Yeah, you know what? Kind of now that I'm thinking about it, Tom. This is very interesting because all of a sudden you said that, and I got this image of that's kind of partly maybe why we were fatigued, because we wound up going through. I seem to remember going through these depressions, and then you'd have to climb up the other side, right? You drop down, I don't know, 25 feet or something like that, and then you'd have to drop up. You climb up the other side, and it wasn't at all clear what was causing these mini depressions, you know, in the landscape, and it could have been that these were sinkholes.
There's a major fault that runs along in the line of the mesa, and there were some sharp sinkholes with sharp edges that would drop down 10 feet or so, maybe six, and I remember one of them had a deer skeleton in it. So it had trapped the deer, and deer couldn't get out.
Wow!
So it was like, whoa, pay attention here.
Yes,
really. But we did the same problem. It took us all day to get out there and get back again. I was really surprised.
Okay. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad it's not something I experienced.
Yeah, doing the same type of itinerary. You guys were starting from down.
Yeah.
In Hollow and trying to just do it for the day and go up and walk around and come back.
Right. So So that's interesting to hear, and I'll have to go back.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting place up there. I don't know if it gets that much visitation, but that whole area is just a really stunning place.
Oh yeah, it really is. It really is. And so I mean, we just had such a wonderful time there, and it was like I say, a whole week, and two of those terraces we didn't actually get to explore.
Right.
And so I'd love to go back and spend more time on in that area, and then potentially do, hike up Fishtail again, just the way we did it, and there may be other ways up Fishtail, if, say, from the west. I don't have any notes about that. I think I would have made a note about it if I had seen something obvious.
Right.
But
a coconut break.
Something to think about, So the next day we got up in the morning, and of course this is our end day, and we had a fairly relaxed, slow walk back. I do remember that when we walked back, and about a mile to the southeast of where one heads up to climb Fishtail, I went up to the saddle between Fishtail and the rim. Art stayed below, but I just wanted to connect with where we had been.
Right.
At the start of our trip, right? And it was kind of surprising. At the beginning of our trip, I did that. The both of us went up, like on the third morning, we hiked up from the Esplanade to this saddle from the south, and there was a nice trail that, you know, went up there. And I kind of expected to see the same trail coming down on the north side, but it wasn't there at all, you know. And so either I missed it, or I was thinking that maybe hikers then come up from the Esplanade there by Fishtail and then are climbing over directly from that saddle to the ascent of Fishtail Mesa, right?
Okay.
That would be one option. Or the other option is, I noted that the slope on the north side is a lot less steep.
Right.
So it's more gentle. So typically, in my experience, the animals are pretty smart trail builders. And where you have a very steep slope, you know, they all consolidate on the best route.
Right.
But where you have a very gentle open slope, there's a lot of options.
They'll scatter out.
They scatter out, right? Right. So that may be why there was no trail going down the north side. But in any event, I did make that. I did connect that line there, so that I have that that reminder of yet another loop. So on a larger scale, and from there it was basically a nice gentle walk back through Indian Hollow. You know, and this was my first time ever up Indian Hollow, so it was a lot of fun to do that, and it was fall, right? And so that's always a special time in some places in the canyon when on the near the rim, because you get the beautiful coloration. And I remember when we got into the Coconino in Indian Hollow, there's a little bit of climbing there, right?
Uh-huh.
It's not anything serious, but just some chimneys and step ups and whatnot. And I remember grabbing a tree or something like that once here or there. And but you know, you're surrounded by these orange and red maples with the white Coconino sandstone, you know,
very pretty.
And there was a little bit of a flow in the creek, so you had this murmur of the water, you know, just a really a splendid image to end the trip with, you know, in my mind. And I mean, here I am 16 years later, and I'm you know, recollecting this and remembering it fondly. So it was a great trip, and you know, we got back to the car and everything was fine. So we just headed over to Jacob Lake Lodge and had our bull and onion sandwich or whatever we typically get over there. So, yeah, that was a nice week with Art on the North Rim.
That's a wonderful, wonderful recollection. Very nice. Well, maybe once again, this is a good time to put a comma in these oral histories, and we will pick up again in 2006. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's right. The next hike was in April. And this is going to be, we went over to, Art and I went over to Asbestos in Vishnu. So this is kind of a big trip for us. So
great.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, with that, this will conclude part 20, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, August 15th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Jim, thank you so very much.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity, Tom. Much appreciated.